Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. Pleasure to have Jade McGonigal on the show today. Jade is a world-renowned game designer and author whose games are designed to improve real lives and solve real problems. Jade is the New York Times bestselling author of Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. And more recently, she's the author of Super Better, a revolutionary approach to getting stronger, happier, braver, and more resilient. Jade is also the inventor and co-founder of the game Super Better, which has helped more than 400,000 people tackle real-life health challenges. Her TED Talks are also immensely popular and have garnered millions and millions of views. Jane, it is so awesome having you on this podcast.
Thank you, Scott.
Am I right? Is that number 400,000 right? Because in an old bio, you had 200,000, but then in the reading your book, I see we're up to 400. You did a study with 400,000. So
yeah, let me update your numbers.
Cool.
So, I mean, we're at 500,000 now for the digital version. Yay! And that's really exciting.
That is super exciting. There's so much we could potentially talk about, and you know, with this sort of topic, it's so innately interesting to me. I have hundreds of pages of notes here, but I want to start off with something, because I feel like in this society, gaming doesn't always get such a good reputation, and it must drive you crazy because of all the science you've seen and you talk about in this book, as well as your own personal scientific studies, which we'll get to later. Why aren't games a mere distraction?
Well, there are many reasons why, Scott. Enough to fill a 450-page book. But you know, the topic that I've been most interested in probably stems from the idea that, you know, we have it all wrong about games, which is that we normally think about games as being the opposite of work, right? Play and work, they're diametrically opposed, like hot and cold, or day and night. But if you look at the research, and even if you look at brain scans of people playing video games, it turns out that the opposite of play isn't work. The opposite of play is depression. And to me, that is the single most important idea that we need to cultivate and integrate into how we try to lead happier, healthier lives.
So reading your book to me felt like I was playing a game. I know that it was in part, large part, designed that way, but I really felt like I was getting immersed in it. I was looking out that window over there. I was jumping up. I was walking. I was doing all these things. It was just really cool. I've never ever read a book in my life where I felt like I was actually like leveling up as each chapter went on.
That's awesome. You know, it's interesting. There've been a lot of books in recent years about the idea of using game design to try to inspire people to change their lives. And I once read a book review that I thought was so insightful and incisive, which said, you know, if this author believes all of these ideas, why is the book not a game? I mean, shouldn't they be really embodying this in their book? And so I thought that was really important for me as a game designer and an author to really try to integrate the ideas. If I think that game design does inspire us to learn better and improve faster, that should be a part of the book. So I'm really glad that it actually delivered that experiential quality.
It did. And I really like how you are really vulnerable and bring in your personal story and how this really motivated you to want to get into this. Now, are you sick of telling the story, but first of all? Because I personally, you know, I have like my own story, blah, blah, blah. And I'm told it so many times the past couple of years that it almost feels like not even me anymore in a way.
Yeah.
How does it feel for you? I don't want to be yet the nth interviewer saying, tell me your story, you know, but.
No. I'll tell you why. You know, I always try to tell it a little bit differently. Like, what else can I share about this experience? So it's a good challenge for me.
Good.
And we should talk about it.
It is really important. It is important.
Yeah. So, I mean, the basics of the story are that 6 years ago, while I was in the middle of writing my first book, Reality's Broken, which was about the psychology of games, I got a traumatic brain injury. And it started out as a simple concussion. And I learned that many concussions do not heal in a few days or a few weeks. Mine actually took a year to really fully recover.
Yeah.
And during that time period, I was fully concussed, couldn't think clearly, couldn't write, couldn't remember things. I was nauseous all the time, migraines every day. Mm. I could barely get out of bed. And like many people with concussions that stretch out for a while, I got severely anxious and depressed. And I learned later that it's not just a consequence of I'm really anxious because I can't work, or I'm depressed because I can't get out of bed. Actually, the brain chemistry changes during the healing process, and depression, anxiety are as much symptoms of the injury as just an emotional reaction to it. And you know, after a month, when my doctor told me that it was looking like it might be 3 months or longer to where I would be feeling better, I sort of hit a wall, and that was when I decided to try to use all of my research to help. So up until that point, I was just kind of waiting to get better and trying to just grit my teeth and get through it. But when, you know, your doctor's telling you it might be 3 months, if it's not 3 months, it might be a year. And if it's not a year to get better, you might be like this forever. Then I knew I needed a new strategy because, I mean, I basically seriously just wanted to kill myself if I was going to be in that much pain and that disabled for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And I know that to many people, killing yourself or inventing a game do not seem like the two most, you know, natural like options. those are my only two options. But you know, I was in the middle of all that research on games and how they make us happier and better problem solvers. So it seemed worth a shot.
Yeah. And not only in this book, you talk about how living a gameful life not just helped with that traumatic brain injury, but lots of other things. You trained for your first marathon. You successfully completed IVF treatment, right? Uh-huh. Which resulted in the birth of your twin daughters. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that.
Yes. Oh, and then that became my new Super Better Challenge. They were actually 10 weeks premature. So
yeah,
they went EQ for 2 months, and I wound up adopting a new secret identity, which is one of the rules of Super Better, to get their own NICU stay, and you know, turned all the nurses and doctors into our allies. And so, yeah, it is a method that you can come back to and play.
Yeah.
Like any good game, you should be able to play it different times with different people, with different strategies. And so I have used it for lots of different things in my life. For more than 500,000 users, the top 5 most common uses, though, are in this order. Number 1 most common is depression. Mm. 2 is anxiety. 3 is a chronic illness of some kind. Number 4 is chronic pain. And number 5 is PTSD. So, I mean, people really are using it to tackle challenges much more serious than you might imagine could be effectively tackled with a game or a gameful mindset.
Now, you mentioned PTSD, and my friend and colleague Anne-Marie Ropke, who is your collaborator on a study, and it's so cool to see you mention her in your book. I think she really deserves, you know, get a lot of attention. I write about her a lot in my own upcoming book on creativity because her research is terrific. Postostatic growth. There's all these other forms of so there's postostatic growth. There's post traumatic growth. Mm-hmm. Right itself. These things, which in the field of positive psychology, which I work in, and you talk a lot about that in the book, and how gaming can be used to for both these things. Could you just explain a little bit for the audience what post-static growth is and what post-traumatic growth is?
Sure. Well, we'll start with post-traumatic growth because that's the one that's been studied, as you know, more extensively.
Uh-huh.
And it's related to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Uh-huh.
It's not the opposite of post-traumatic stress disorder, which it sounds like, because many people who have post-traumatic growth also experienced post-traumatic stress disorder first, you know, as they wrestle with the trauma. But the scientific literature suggests that it's actually fairly common for people to go through a traumatic experience and come out on the other side feeling stronger in some way. Maybe they feel like they understand their own resilience better. They feel better understood by their friends and family. Maybe they feel like they can change their priorities now to lead a life that's truer to what really matters to them, maybe less about what others expect of them. These sort of positive outcomes where they take a terrible and traumatizing experience and use it to kind of become a stronger, braver, and often in many ways happier version of themselves, even though they went through this terrible thing. And so some researchers, as you know, have been wondering, is there any way to get these benefits without a trauma? Because obviously, you know,
trauma sucks.
Yeah, nobody would wish to go through these things that even if they yield these amazing life-changing benefits. So Anne-Marie Ripke was one of the first people to really look for other kinds of life experiences that are usually identified as positive experiences, but seem to share some of the qualities of traumatic experiences that help us grow. And she was really looking at things that force you to dig deep, fail a lot, maybe even suffer a lot as you're trying to reach your goal or embrace the experience. So things like training for a marathon, becoming a parent for the first time, writing a book. By the way, I did all three things last year, so I am the most post-ecstatic growth person on the planet.
Can you OD on post-ecstatic growth? Is that like ODing on ecstasy?
I know. I'm living it. But post-ecstatic growth is the term that she coined to describe this. And it's not, I mean, we're not talking about standing on a mountaintop and having a rave. You know, it's not just ecstasy. It's doing things that you've chosen, that you are excited about, that you are happy to be doing, but they're going to be a significant enough challenge to your resources, to your skills and capabilities, that you are going to be forced to wrestle with what you're capable of, really reach out to friends and family for help in many of the same ways that you do with a trauma. And it turns out that you can experience a lot of the same benefits. So with Superbetter, which seems to be pretty effective at generating post-traumatic growth, we've seen a lot of people try to, you know, do this sort of sneak in this back door to those benefits by using it for exactly those kinds of things, writing books, trying to start their own company, training for Ironman events and things like that. And I would say so far, our data suggests that weirdly, it may be easier to get these benefits from trauma than it is from these things that you choose for yourself. And that's something I'm interested in exploring further in our research to see if there's anything we can do about that, or maybe it's just a matter of when you're forced to confront something that you didn't choose for yourself, that it really does bring out something different in terms of the sort of starkness as you kind of look at yourself and look at the world and figure out, you know, what you're made of and what you want to, what you want to give back to the world.
It's like the famous philosophy experiment with the experience machine. You know, you could be if you give people the option to have simulate pleasurable experiences every second of their entire life, very few people take it. They would rather have authentic, challenging experiences than a whole life of simulating pleasure.
Well, you know, that's really interesting because one of my favorite philosophers, a gentleman by the name of Bernard Suits, he's a Canadian philosopher who has passed away just recently.
My best friend is a Canadian philosopher.
Oh, yeah. So maybe they used to hang out and philosophize.
Probably. He's like my age. Yeah.
He wrote my all-time favorite book on games, which was called The Grasshopper on Utopia Playing Games. And his philosophical premise was that if we achieved a utopian society, no hunger, no poverty, no war, that the only thing we would be able to do to avoid going crazy and killing ourselves would be to play games. That we would have to invent these obstacles, right? He calls them unnecessary obstacles, to bring a sense of meaning and purpose to our lives. If all the real problems are solved, we would need games to fulfill our desire to be challenged and to connect. And I think that's absolutely true.
I agree too. It is that challenge part is very essential. You know, we could sit there eating bonbons and watching reality TV and yeah, maybe a pleasurable experience, but people that go through that don't report any personal growth at all. They don't report any increase in meaning in their lives.
Definitely not.
So clearly there's more to that. You know, you just made me think when we talk about the importance of challenge, it's so strongly tied to the flow literature. Mm-hmm. And I know that you've told me, you know, in our correspondence that the gaming community is really big admirers of Mihai Csikszentmihalyi's research.
Mm-hmm. Is that right?
So, you know, his model of flow is that there should be, you know, the challenge should be not completely matched. Mm-hmm. It should be just a little bit harder than your current skill level. And so when you're designing games, do you, in general, when game designers design games, how much do they take into account, like, the average ability level of the player? I mean, it's so tricky because there's such individual variation, right, of people playing these games. And when you're designing it, are you designing it for the average? Who are you designing it for, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, one of the good things about games is that typically every new player of a game is bad at it because they don't know how to play. They never played it before. And so in a way, you don't actually have to worry about people's individual skills and abilities. Games are pretty equalizing early on. You know, if you've played the game for 1,000 hours, you may be amazingly better than someone else who's played it for 1,000 hours because you have natural gifts and talents or previous experience that you can draw on. But most people, when we start playing games, we're terrible. We don't know how they work. It's total trial and error. We're learning it. So, I mean, most game designers it's pretty easy every player who comes to your game for the first time is essentially, you know, kind of like a blank slate. So that's one way to look at it. I mean, another way to look at it, in the kinds of games that I design, a lot of the games that I've designed, which are meant to achieve real world goals, I am thinking about how do I get that challenge curve to the right spot that someone can experience flow. I think they may already have a challenge in mind, and my job as a game designer is to figure out what I need to do to get them up, get their skills and ability levels up to the point where they can meet that challenge. So just to give you an example, I had the chance to design a game for the New York Public Library a few years ago. And they were like, what do you want? I don't know, do whatever you want with the game, but we want it to be at the library. And I decided that the goal of the game should be to write a book, because almost 90% of young people in the United States say they want to write a book someday. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, let's start working with a real goal that people have. Okay, that's a challenge, write a book. As a game designer, my job is to figure out what does the average person need in the way of support, resources, allies, power-ups to make it possible for anybody to write a book within a certain number of hours of engaging with the game. They need inspiration. They might need peer editors, line editors. You know, they need a structure. You know, I should create a structure that any author can come in and play with it. So, I mean, I'm a little different from a video game designer in that way. I do think about flow a lot, but I think a lot about my job as a real world game designer is to improve people's skills and abilities so that they can meet the challenge that they've already decided to embrace.
That's so good. You know, you talk a lot in your book about, and I see analogs to the deliberate practice literature. You know, Kay Anders Ericsson argues that it's not so much the amount of hours of deliberate practice that are important, it's the quality of those hours.
Yeah, always on the edge of your ability. Right. Yeah.
And so I see analogs to the kinds of things you're talking about in your book when you talk about why you need a good balance between game pursuits and real world goals. And you say that people who play video games, and you say about 3 hours a day tend to reap the benefits of play. So you would probably argue that really, you know, it's the quality of those game full experiences that matter more than just sheer hours. You know, are you getting in flow? Are you challenging yourself? Are you pushing yourself? You also make a distinction between playing to escape versus playing with purpose.
Yeah.
Wondering if you could talk a little more about that.
Sure. Well, I mean, the good news for people who don't want to spend a lot of time playing games is that when you look at the peer-reviewed literature, studies that have found benefits like decreased depression, decreased anxiety, improved mood, improved relationships with the family member you play with, they have found these benefits for as little as 20 minutes, 3 times a week.
Wow.
So you can make a difference. And even, you know, for studies where they're looking at video games as like a cognitive vaccine against PTSD, I'm sure you've seen the Oxford University studies that playing Tetris for 10 minutes within 24 hours of a traumatic experience.
I love Tetris.
Yeah. Well, everybody should have it on their phone, because if you see a trauma or experience a trauma, you play it for 10 minutes within 24 hours. And it diverts the mind's eye, basically, to have flashbacks of the game instead of the trauma. It's been shown to decrease flashbacks and symptoms of PTSD. So, and that's just 10 minutes of gameplay. So, as you say, it's really about what is the right game at the right time. And you don't have to be playing for hours a day. Although, if you are playing for more than 3 hours a day, the research literature suggests there are opportunity costs. And we do see some of the negative effects that have been associated with video games, like being more depressed, being more anxious, being socially isolated from people who aren't playing the same game, and even worse, you know, worse performance at work or school. That's just because there's only so many hours in a day. And if you tend to be playing more than 3 hours a day, it's just mathematically impossible to put the necessary effort and time into physical activity, maintaining relationships outside the game, school and work and that sort of thing. So that seems to be a little bit of a tipping point. I did a meta-analysis of every study that's looked at addiction and negative impacts, and no study found negative impacts at under 20 hours a week. Whereas many studies did at some were at 20 hours a week, some were at 30 hours a week. So, but it just seemed pretty clear that there's a safe cutoff point. If you're under 20 hours a week, nobody's finding negative impacts. So, there's one exception to that, which I do talk about in the book, which is, you know, you can play 20 hours a week trying to kill strangers online. And that right. does seem to create a kind of testosterone poisoning effect.
Seemed to be so good. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's what I like about your book. You add this nuance about these specific features of gaming that are important. I mean, saying a blanket statement like games will improve your social life, you know, increase your social connect. I mean, just a blanket statement like that is not as meaningful as actually being able to say what are the exact features that, you know, will increase social affiliation and things like that.
Yeah. And that's one of my goals in writing this book is there are more than 1,000 studies that have done a really good job of trying to figure out what are the features of different games that produce different benefits, but they're all behind academic firewalls. By the way,
if you ever need anything that's behind an academic firewall, let me know.
I have a friend in the academy. That's good. You can be my friend in the academy. That's great.
Oh, okay. I thought you were saying you already have a friend.
I do have friends that I'm constantly emailing people for PDFs of scientific articles.
I have another friend that does that all the time. She sends me a long list of articles.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know if I should be admitting that in public. Is that like legal technically?
No. That's like, I mean, we basically, it's like almost like an academic civil rights movement. We need
that's
people
how I feel.
To just, we need civil disobedience or we just freely spread our research. So that people can access it. But yeah, so anyway, you know, we have 1.23 billion people on this planet who spend on average an hour a day playing video games. Right. What percentage of them can access the scientific papers? I don't know, less than 1%. So
right.
I'm really trying to help make sure people have access to the really practical findings that can help them lead happier, healthier lives.
Absolutely. You know, I study the psychology of creativity and I study the psychology of play. But when I say that, it's funny because the whole research, scientific literature on the science I'm not talking about gaming, the science of play.
Yeah.
There's like not one study about video games. It's all about like pretend play.
Don't get me started.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I mean, to be
people
fair.
People are always. Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
I want to be fair because my mentor in grad school, Jerome Singer, is a pioneer in the field of pretend play. So he's done a lot of really good, important work, but it kind of stops there, right? It's a good start, but yeah. So I was gonna say it must drive you crazy.
People are always sending me books and articles by people who study play saying, oh, you must love this person, you must love this research. And I'll be like, oh, maybe I do. They say play is good. Great. Let me look at it. Inevitably, they say something negative about video games, that it doesn't qualify as the right kind of play. It's too structured. It's too goal-oriented. It's too much screen time. One of the great books on play to come out in the last, I don't know, decade, play, like not video game play, but it right. has to be a certain special kind of make-believe play.
By Peter Gray, the one by Peter Gray?
I would say by Stuart Brown.
Oh, Stuart Brown, yeah, yeah.
I think it's just called Play, right?
Yeah.
Oh my God, people are always saying, you must love that book.
Right.
But there's a whole chapter on how sad and pathetic video gamers are.
Yeah.
And, besides how incredibly damaging it is to shame an entire generation of young people, and has all kinds of consequences for their self-esteem and their ability to actually benefit from these games. I actually think there's something very special about goal-oriented play that builds a different kind of resilience, because in order to be resilient, you have to have a goal that you're focused on.
Right.
You know, in make-believe play, you're constantly shifting and changing because everything's free. You can always accommodate whatever new idea or direction it goes in. There's no need for resilience. And we know, I believe, if you look at literature, the number one benefit people get from playing games is resilience in the face of setbacks, the ability to stay focused on a goal and stay optimistic and recruit allies and try different strategies, have that psychological flexibility. And so I think the goal orientation nature of gameplay, to me, is personally, it has a special relevance if we're trying to improve people's real life. It's different from creativity. But I wanted to ask you a question, if I can turn the tables on the interviewer.
Of course.
So people are trying to study the impact of games on creativity, particularly in kids. And it would be helpful to me, when I talk to the public about some of the studies, to get an expert opinion on some of the measures they're using. So what is your expert opinion on the Torrance test of creativity?
Well, unfortunately, that's the best we have right now. And, the big thing we're doing in the Imagination Institute is we just gave out $3 million to create a new imagination scale that actually uses – we just recently announced our winners of 16 innovative approaches to studying imagination from virtual reality worlds. Oh, that's right up your alley. Looking at narrative creativity too. We really need – the field needs to get new measures. The Torrance test was a good start. Just like pretend play was a good start in understanding play. We really do need to evolve. The field needs to evolve. So it has, these terms of how many uses for a brick are there, how many coming up with all these things on the spot it's only the very small part of, I'm terrible at metaphors. I'm trying to say a small part of the iceberg. Does that even make any sense? That does make sense though, right? The tip of the iceberg.
It's not useless.
It's not useless. It correlates with real world creative achievement 30, 40 years later.
Okay.
But the thing that's interesting, and this you might find this interesting, is that E. Paul Torrance, by the way, is one of my intellectual heroes, and he initiated this monumental longitudinal study and they're still following up these adults now. They start off as elementary school kids with Torrance in the 50s and 60s, and they're still following them up, and they found that the best predictor of lifelong creativity, personally meaningful as well as publicly recognized, was not his Torrance tests. Oh, it was not any test. It wasn't the IQ test or the standardized test. It was something much simpler and yet complex at the same time. It was the extent to which the kids fell in love with a future image of themselves when they were really young. He found that far and away that one variable predicted 30. It's the only thing that stood the test of time. 30, 40 years later, whereas IQ and his divergent thinking tests lost their predictive powers dramatically.
Wow! So they would imagine themselves in their sort of dream role. What are you doing? What are you creating? What are you contributing? Is that the sort of?
Yeah. So a lot of them fell in love with the future image of themselves, but then a lot of them just fell in love with something. So he has a beautiful journal article towards the end of his life he wrote called The Importance of Falling in Love with Something. It's my favorite articles ever. And he shows how this, even at a very young age, people tend to show themes of what they're going to be someday in life if we just listen to them. And the thing I like about Torrens is he really took the time to listen to people. He did create the most used creativity test of all time, but what people don't realize is he also discovered lots of other variables that were equally predictive. Another really important predictive variable was the extent to which you're happy being a minority of one. So the extent to which you are happy having idea and holding on to that idea, even if everyone's ridiculing you or telling you.
Hey, well, I'm a good, yeah. That explains a lot of my
exactly.
success, I think. It's
exactly.
been a long time being the only person periodically.
Exactly.
But that's so interesting. I have a couple of thoughts to that. So I think our audience might be interested to know that there have been studies looking at using the Torrens test of creativity mm-hmm. to see if video game play has an effect
right.
on scores on that test. And it does, according to the studies that have been published, that the kids who spend more time playing games have an increase in score. There's no causation. It's not a causation thing. I mean, they just found that they didn't like give kids video games to play for 6 months and see if their score went up. It was just kids who happen to spend a lot of time playing video games seem to score significantly higher.
We should do
on
that
it.
Study.
We should. Oh my God. Can you imagine the kids like you, they'd be like lining up the door to, you know, I get to play more video games for 6 months.
Yeah. I'll ask my students in positive psychology class if any
yeah.
of them.
But so that's interesting. And one thing that the researchers really pointed out with that is with any genre of game, it wasn't just, you know, games that we associate with increasing creativity like Minecraft. It was even right. playing, you know, shooter games, which we have all sorts of anxiety about. So that was interesting. Now, can I tell you a personal story about
yeah.
myself based on what you just were sharing? This idea of that early childhood, like the things that we fall in love with can give us a glimpse into where our biggest achievements and contributions to society might be someday. When I was, when I just graduated from college, I was living in a tiny little apartment with a roommate in New York City. And we had like,
what's her name? Lady Gaga.
I wish, we had like 40 mice that would like inhabit the apartment. And I was just miserable. And I like one day I went to put on my running shoes and there was a dead mouse in the shoe. And that was just sort of for me a low point. I was like, I need to change my life. I was working at a .com company at the time. And I called my sister and she's like, my twin sister, Kelly McGonigal, who many people will know, she teaches psychology at Stanford University. She's written all the amazing books about willpower and stress. So of course she's my own personal guru. At the time she was doing her PhD at Stanford and she gave me this exercise out of a book that was supposed to help you figure out what you want to do with your life. So she gave me this exercise that was supposed to help you figure out what you should do to make a more meaningful contribution. And the exercise was think about what you were really drawn to when you were the youngest age you can remember and what people, you know, praise you for being good at, better than average. And so I'm like, well, what was I doing back then? And the two things came to mind. One was that I always was making up games, like games for the playground. I'd be like, let's invent a new playground game. Or I'd make giant board games on our basement floor. You're not digital. This is before we had computers at home. So that was one thing. I was like, well, okay. I was like making up games. And then the other thing was I was always like giving speeches. I'd like stand up on a chair in kindergarten and give a speech, or, you know, I'd like write an essay and give it in front of the school auditorium or something. So I was like, okay, well, obviously, some kind of career involving making up weird games and giving speeches. But at the time I was, you know, an editor for a .com website. I was not applied to grad school or anything yet. And I just think it's really funny that at the time I was like, well, there's no career that involves making up weird games and giving speeches.
Oh.
So like fast forward, you know, 15
that's your life
later. That was in fact the best career for me to pursue. It took more than a decade to actually kind of make up a career like that. So that's evidence that, you know, one of your intellectual hero mentors.
That's exactly what he talks about.
Perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. you know, these themes are there if we choose to see them, we choose to get in touch with them. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And we may not know what they mean right away, you know, because that's the true creativity. You may have had a couple things that you fell in love with as a kid that nobody else has fallen in love with in the same way. And you're going to have to invent a career, invent a role in society. That's the true creativity, I think.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with that, actually. Absolutely want to make sure we talk about your game, Super Better. You know, I have it on my iPhone. I'm not that good at it, but I'm trying. I'm working.
How can you not be good? I mean, the only way to not be good at it is to ignore it, I would think. But I mean, let's. It's really interesting because the word game is something I've been struggling with to describe this. So now I just call it a method, because when we put it in the App Store, actually the first sentence in the App Store description was Super Better is not a game, because I have designed a lot of games, and this is not a game in the way that other things I've designed have been games. And I've come to realize that this is really, I mean, it's a mindset intervention that uses some of the tropes of gaming. But really what we're doing is we're teaching you to think like a game designer. We're teaching you the strategies that game designers use to help their players achieve more audacious goals, to be more resilient in the face of setbacks, to be better able to learn and improve. So I'm really careful trying to think about how do I explain this to people, because I don't want you to download the app and think you're going to be playing a game like Tetris or Candy Crush Saga. It's more like a class. It's like a course in mastering all of these amazing superpowers that game designers have, and you just are learning to unleash them in your own life. You know, what does it take to design a good power up? What does it mean to identify a bad guy and have all like five different strategies for tackling it? You know, that what is a good quest for you that you can design for yourself? So this is a small nuance that I'm trying to play around with.
What is the definition of a game?
Well, my definition of a game is most influenced by that wonderful philosopher I mentioned earlier, Bernard Suits. He said a game is an unnecessary obstacle that we volunteer to try to overcome. So if you think about golf, this is a classic example. In golf, your goal is to get a small ball in a small hole. And if you were not playing a game, how would you do that? You would walk up to the hole and put the ball in, and you'd be like, yes, I did it. But because it's a game, you allow there to be this totally unnecessary obstacle in your way. You have to stand really far away from the hole. That is an unnecessary obstacle that provokes curiosity. You know, can I do it? It provokes creativity. What's the best way? Let me try different strategies. It promotes learning and improvement, because you've never done this before, so you have to learn and improve. And not to mention using a club, which is also a totally inefficient way to achieve this goal. So for me, a game is really just leaning into these voluntary obstacles that provoke curiosity and creativity and give us the experience to learn and improve.
I like that definition a lot. And your game, Super Better.
You're still going to call it. I call it a method. It's a method.
Can I just call it a method?
Yeah, it's a method that you can learn through the book, or you can learn it through the app or the web platform, or you can, you know, learn it just by listening to a podcast, really. I mean, because it's really just a way of, it's a systematic way of tackling challenges in everyday life through the eyes of, as if you were a game designer.
And you paired up with Annie. Mm-hmm. To do the study, mm-hmm. and you found that it significantly reduced symptoms of depression, anxiety, increased optimism, social support, and self-efficacy, mm-hmm. which is basically self-confidence for our listeners.
And by the way, this study was with people who met the criteria for clinical depression. So not just anybody, but people with a significant amount of depression that they were experiencing. And one thing that's interesting about the study is, you know, we had people participating who were not receiving any treatment. We had people who were on prescription medication for their depression, and we had people who were in therapy or counseling. And all three groups improved at similar rates. The sort of distance that they moved on the depression scale was similar, whether they were no treatment, medication, or therapy. So that was really kind of awesome to see that this can help no matter what you're doing to try to get better, that this creates, this adds a layer of improvement.
And it also, they felt significantly happier, more satisfied with their lives. So this is really, it would count as a positive intervention. You know, you have lots of psychological interventions that are designed to get you from like negative 15 to zero. But this is really a good example of what I would consider in the class of positive interventions, which are designed to get you from negative 15 to positive 15.
Yeah. So, and I mean, I do think, I mean, when I, as you know, from the start of the book, when people first started using the same method after I made some videos about it, and they would write me and say that they were, you know, playing a version of the game for really significant traumas, things much worse than me. A young man in his 20s who had just gotten a terminal cancer diagnosis, untreatable. That's it. You know, a young father with two daughters under the age of 10 who just gotten an ALS diagnosis. You know, people who were grieving for the loss of a beloved spouse, you know, 20 years of marriage and then suddenly to lose them. And they were talking about how this game or this method was helping them be happier and stronger, braver. That was when I realized that there was something weird going on here, that it's not just like about treating depression or anxiety. And that was actually how I found the literature on post-traumatic growth.
Right.
So I do think that this is, it's not just about typical resilience and getting back to normal. And that's actually where the name Super Better comes from. This right. is it. I don't know if I talk about this. I don't often talk about this. The name Super Better was inspired by the fact that, you know, when you have any kind of traumatic brain injury, you don't really know how much better you're going to get in the sense of, will I get back to normal? And everybody's telling you, get better soon. And what they mean is, please get back to normal and be at the exact same level of cognitive ability that you were before.
Exactly.
And you don't know if you're going to get there. And so I thought every time someone would say that, I wanted to tell them, I don't know if I'm going to get better. And I was mentally preparing for having to come up with a different life plan that had a different, you know, career and a different situation for my family. So I thought to myself, well, I may not get better in the sense of being back to normal, but maybe I can still become a better version of myself. So I won't be the old Jane. I'll be a new Jane that's come through this and just being some more of a, just a badass version of myself for having gone through this. And so that was, to me, that's where the name Super Better came from. So I can't get better, but I'll get super better. It'll be like beyond what I was before, because I may never be just the same person I was. And so that idea of going beyond getting back to normal, having that positive impact that goes even above resilience or normal coping, you know, positive coping.
You sound like such a positive psychologist.
I'm sure I am. You know,
I'm saying you should add that to your bio.
I should add that to my bio. Yeah, I had that really funny experience with Marty Seligman earlier in my career.
Oh, tell me about that one.
Well, you know, I was trying to figure out why, I was looking at the psychology of games, why when people play games, do they seem to not suffer? That was sort of a question I was really interested in. And why do they feel so optimistic and engaged? And they seem to derive meaning and purpose from an activity that other people see as meaningless and purposeless, but they seem to be so much meaning and purpose. So it's sort of breaking down what do games do effectively more than other things in our lives. And I came up with this criteria of four things. That was the same time that Marty was working on his new PERMA scheme. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the things necessary for a meaningful and purposeful life? And, you know, you've got the P for positive emotions, E for engagement, R for relationships, M for meaning, so connecting to a bigger than self. And then he added A, controversially, for like achievement and accomplishment. Mm-hmm. So we were both just sort of doing this separately. And the first time I met him, you know, started to share my research, I was just like, by the way, it's a perfect match. You know, what I've figured out that games do so well, and what you've identified as a criteria for a meaningful and purposeful life, I was lucky. So at that point, he's like, oh, very interesting. Let me, you know, take you under my wing and help you figure this out more. That was 10 years ago now, but that, seeing that connection between what great researchers in psychology were saying yielded these important emotional and mental benefits and what I could clearly see game designers were doing. Yeah. Purposefully and elegantly. That was one of the big aha light bulb moments, you know, of my life, to make me think, well, there's something going on here with game design. It's not just escapist activity. It's not just entertainment. It's not just way to pass the time. Right. That we're really activating core needs, core psychological needs. And you know, it would be great if we could translate that also to other aspects of our lives.
Yes. And I love how in your book, you have these personal stories that show such diversity of ways that people have showed this growth through, you know, like curing insomnia, grief, people wanting to be sexier, you know.
And it's sexier. One of the women in the book, Joyce Kerwin, had mm-hmm. just retired. She wanted to be sexier for her husband, it worked apparently. So she was very happy.
Or even just finding a new spark in life or something.
Yeah.
I really like that. You have this whole section of your book on all these rules of Super Better to help get the most out of each day. And, you know, I want people to buy the book and to go through that. So I won't read all the rules and things, but I found them really personally helpful to me. A lot of these exercises are really good. I like the mind reading machine. I selected all the ones that I really like a lot. I like coming up with a secret identity. I think I did that a lot as a kid, just as a creative kid who wasn't too happy with my own identity as a learning disabled. But, you know, it was really good to come up with a secret identity where I was this like, you know, computer hacker, you know, or something. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, that's a whole other story.
I know. Actually, it's one of the most wonderful things that you can do in Superbetter is to share your secret identity with someone. It turns out to be amazingly gratifying. People really enjoy coming up with a secret identity. Yeah. But when somebody tells you their secret identity, it's such a window into, you know, who they want to be right now, you know, what they're looking forward to becoming, trying to create in their lives. And I just love it. I mean, when even just at book signings this month, people come up to me and have me sign it for their secret identity. And, you know, I'm like, it's like last night in Portland, I met somebody who his secret identity was Sidekick Man.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, Sidekick Man, like that doesn't even, who wants to be the sidekick? Doesn't everyone want to be Batman, not Robin? So I was like, immediately intrigued, you know, what are sidekicks, you know, man's superpowers? Cause like, I've never heard of that kind of superhero. And he's like, oh, you know, well, I'm just right now I'm taking a sort of backseat to my wife's career. And I'm like really being like a primary parent. And, you know, my job is to really be there for my wife right now and give her career, you know, sort of primary role. And I don't know, it's just that he was, instead of thinking about it as being a kind of, I don't know, lower status function in the family hierarchy,
support,
he was looking
support.
At it as a superpower. Yeah. So it's really, you learn a lot about people and what's in their hearts. And
I love that.
Yeah. So but you're not going to tell me your secret identity. You'll have to, you know, that should be like in the notes for this episode. You should put it at the very bottom, like an Easter egg.
Okay.
For people
I'll do
who've listened to the whole episode. They get a little special.
I'm totally going to do it. I'm going to make a note to do note secret identity. Okay. I'm just making notes of stuff. So, what is an epic win?
Well, in Superbetter terms, an epic win is, it's a moment or outcome where you feel it truly represents that you have gotten super better, that you have sort of transcended some old ability or limitations on yourself. And you feel like this represents a stronger, braver, happier version of yourself. And a lot of these epic wins are not planable at the start of your journey. Obviously for me, when I started playing this game, which I called Jane the Concussion Slayer, my goal, if you'd ask me, my goal was just to be able to work again. I think I wanted to go back to finishing my book. I wanted to be able to go back to running if I could do my first, you know, 5K. And the little win. But the real epic win, of course, was inventing something that could help people, you know, experience post-traumatic growth. And I would never have expected that when I first got a concussion, right? So we try to help people see these new windows, right? You know, that old saying, a door closes and a window opens, which we know is one of the psychological skills associated with the ability to experience post-traumatic growth, is looking for these positive outcomes that weren't possible before. So that's, we try, you know, those are the kinds of epic wins that I get most excited about. People kind of divert their classic goal orientation towards celebrating things that are, you know, more meaningful to them than they would have been able to identify before they started.
Yeah. And I love how you talk about how living, you know, orienting your whole life towards beating your personal record, and how that can, you can allows yourself to give yourself, especially like how you say, you encourage people to give yourself permission to do what matters most to you today, like right now, like right. There's nothing stopping me from looking out my window. And, you know, or like, you know, like I really love
that. You keep mentioning looking at your window. I should say for listeners, we just try to get you to do things to provoke different positive emotions, and looking at your window is a way to provoke curiosity, because
it does for me.
You don't know what you might see.
But I love that.
And you can also look in windows is the other technique that works, but you have to be careful which windows you look into for legal and for propriety's sake.
Absolutely. You just made me, you activated something. So like a lot, there is a form of therapy for people who have suffered from social anxiety where they try to treat life as a game. It's actually a well-known therapy, and it's been applied in lots of techniques and some would argue dodgy ways. So there's a whole community called the pickup artists. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. Ugh.
They
call it the game, which is terrible.
Exactly.
Yeah. But you know what's wrong with that, right? You know why it's not a game? Because one of the principles, rules of games, besides it, there are four things, you know, it's a voluntary obstacle, you get feedback, there's a clear win condition, but the fourth condition of a game is participation is voluntary and conscious.
Right.
So you can't play a game if you don't know you're playing a game and you haven't chosen freely to play it. So with a pickup artist, the person who is a pickup artist is playing a game with people who don't know there's
don't
a game,
know it. Right.
have not voluntarily or consciously entered into the game. So it's not a game.
Yeah.
So that is, you know, something we must keep in mind when we use game as a metaphor. Mm-hmm. It is not an effective or sincere metaphor if you're talking about people who aren't consciously choosing to play.
I think that makes a lot of sense. You love your Super Better community, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you've studied them and you've noticed that there's a lot of diversity amongst them, right? It's not just like your Super Better community is like they're just one type of person, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at the demographics for people who've done the digital version that we've been able to collect data from, it skews slightly female. I think depending on when we measure it, as much as 60% female, but you know, ages range from 13 to, I mean, super old, almost centenarians, and people who say they've never played a video game, although I don't believe them, because usually those people play solitaire constantly on their, you know, PCs or their phones. So, but people who say they've never played a video game, to people who play all the time. And so it is a diverse group, because everyone has a game that they love. It might be bridge, it might be poker, it might be golf, it might be basketball, you know, pandemic, whatever. Even if you're not a video gamer, there's some game that you love that you naturally adopt and practice this gameful mindset in. So it seems to be pretty easy for people to get into the Super Better mindset.
Cool. And you say you have a goal in life to see a game developer win a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking medicine might be a more effective strategy. You know, when I first said that, I think I set the year 2023 as the year that I predicted it would happen. That was using my future forecasting skills. So we've still got 8 years left to rally the troops to work on games that are worthy of a Nobel Prize. I do think, you know, when I talk about in the book, games being used to treat severe pain, anxiety, depression more effectively than pharmaceuticals with fewer side effects, and certainly less expensively, I feel like that is a realistic proposition, you know, if we can, use games, I would be ready to give a Nobel Prize to the inventor of Tetris right now already. Just, you know,
me too.
But for it seems to be the best video game we have in terms of its potential therapeutic uses for anxiety, depression, and PTSD. So, you know, if the Nobel Committee would ask me, I'd give it to that guy.
I'm going to end here because, you know, we've talked so much about all of these benefits of living a gameful life. And I want to just repeat a quote that I love from your book. You said, "The biggest benefit of getting stronger, happier, and braver is finding the courage and means to live a life truer to your dreams right now, no matter what obstacles you face along the way." And I personally can't think of any better reason to do anything in this world. So thank you so much for all the great work you do and for chatting with me today, Jane.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as informative and thought-provoking as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can go to thepsychologypodcast.com.